Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Mickey Finn, born Michael Shanahan, didn't find guiding. Guiding found him. Mickey spends his days guiding in Australia's snowy mountains. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss brown trout, using UV in flies, anxiety, building a raft, and more. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Great Fishing Adventures of Australia. The diversity of Australia's fishing experiences is as vast as the country itself. Great Fishing Adventures of Australia is the catch of Australia's best fishing operators that have come together to collectively raise the profile of Australia as a world-class fishing destination. No matter what the season, Australia offers enthusiasts the opportunity to indulge in their passion and experience some of the world's very best fishing amongst some of the most naturally spectacular environments the world has to offer. Discover your next fishing adventure by visiting australia.com/fishing. Again, that's www.australia.com/fishing.
Born in Canberra, which is the Australian Capital Territory. It's kind of like the Washington, D.C. of Australia. It's a little state within a state. For anyone who's never been here, everyone makes fun of it because it's small. It's full of public servants and government officials and journalists, which is what my family was. So we moved there. My dad was and still is a journo, which is short for journalist in Australia. I'll just clarify all of those as I go.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Canberra. So it's about halfway between the mountains and the sea. And we were very lucky growing up in that mum and dad, we had a cool little place down on the coast where we could go during summer holidays. And then when I was about 8 or 9, we got a little place up in the mountains and we built a up the top near Adaminaby, which is where my dad's family's from.
For people listening right now, this is super awkward because I'm leaning in close to Mickey because I'm recording on one microphone.
He's and like, I'm leaning so away so face? We don't kill it. Exactly.
We're doing this in person.
Yeah.
I haven't done an in-person podcast in since COVID hit.
I know.
But I'm here on a fishing trip in the mountains, which is why I just pointed at the mountains when you said mountains. But we're using this as an opportunity to meet up and do this podcast on a single microphone. So if the audio sounds sus, that's why. It's because we've gone old school.
But exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, so these mountains here.
Yeah. So this is the foothills of the Snowy Mountains. We're on the other side from where I grew up. Canberra's on the other side. And Adaminaby, which is where our property was growing up, is right smack dab in the middle, right up high. And I basically grew up in Canberra, but I mean, we were super lucky. We got to go up to the mountains, down to the coast. And so jumping between the two, just going fishing, doing whatever we wanted, building houses, helping mum and dad out. And got a lot of brothers and sisters, so we were a useful army, basically. So we could go and do all the work on various places, and because we built the place up at Adaminaby, and we did a lot of work on Congo too as well, down the coast, and a few other things. And, yeah, just went, basically was at school the whole time in Canberra, went to university in Canberra, and, yeah, now I'm down here in Tumut on the other side of the mountains, which is cool. But, yeah, just kicking around between the mountains and the sea.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. Sorry, it feels so weird leaving it. I've actually never had to do this before.
I know. It looks hilarious. So for anyone who can't see this, April is currently hugging the microphone to attempt to get her voice across.
I'm going
to
take a picture when this is done and I will post
exactly.
it. Okay, so Mickey Finn is what we're calling you.
Yeah.
But can you tell us the story behind your name? Because people who see this episode, they're going to say, Mickey Finn, this man must be 100. Who's the original Mickey Finn? Tell us your real name and the story behind your name.
So, my name is not Mickey Finn. My mum will get very upset if she sees Mickey Finn. My name is Michael Shanahan.
You know I'm going to post it as Mickey Finn.
Oh, you have to. Yeah, you got to. Okay. Well, that's my problem is I've got this stage name now. It's like walking around. It's hilarious and conceited at the same time. But basically, I was doing... so it all started because I was at university doing English and history just as an undergrad degree and, you know, fishing and doing everything else in between. And then I also did a Master's of Teaching, which is used to be called a Diploma of Education. It's just... It's really... It's a short course. It's like a year or two. And you go in and then after that you can teach because I wanted to be a teacher. And obviously other stuff got in the way. But during that course, I had all my, I'd already was guiding. I was already fishing heaps and everything else. And I had a little business called Mickey Finn's Fly Guiding, which I was very proud of. And still am. Classic business name. But basically they said that we had to change all of our Instagram things while we were teaching so kids wouldn't find us. So I changed mine from Michael Shanahan, which is what it was, to Mickey Finn. And then it's basically stuck. So ever since I teamed up with my now business partner, Josh, and he basically is the Instagram king of the world, just sees everything through an Instagram focus lens.
Josh Hutchins. Josh Hutchins from Aussie Fly Fisher, because he's been on the show too.
Exactly, exactly. And so he thought my name, he even, like my first few invoices and stuff that I'd send through, he had Finn on the thing. And I was like, dude, we need to change this to Shanahan. He was like, is your last name Shanahan? And I was like, yeah. And it's a really important name too as well, because I mean, if you drive up to the mountains on the back road to Canberra, that you go over Shanahan's Mountain and you go over, and my family on that side are all Shanahans and Delaney's. You go over Delaney's Creek up on the Eucombine, even Denison Campground, like, Denison, like my dad's name is Dennis. Like this, if you go up to the Adaminaby Cemetery, in fact, there's a Michael Liam Shanahan, which is my exact name. And he was my great granduncle, and he was only 2 years old when he died back in, you know, early 19, late 1800s sort of thing.
How did he die?
Oh, he just would have been an infant in the Snowy Mountains, which, you know, wouldn't be a fantastic place to be. You know, a lot of big Irish families, and I guess, you know, if they lost a couple of kids up there, it wasn't too out of the blue. Because it is, to give people a geographical idea, it's very remote for Australia. Probably, you know, 100, 150 years ago, and there were gold rushes up there and everything else, but mainly it was sheep stations. Very famous for sheep, which I hate, because my grandfather was a shearer. And so he instilled an early hatred of sheep into our family. And so mum and dad, super supportive, best parents ever. But at the same time, dad, as whenever we were driving past sheep, would just complain. It's just like, you know, how much they stink and how much he hates them. And as a fly fishing guide, I can relate, because the one thing you always find up on a pristine river is some sheep that's gotten lost and he's gotten caught in a fence and you got to go and sort it out. And it's just terrible. I have no time for sheep unless I'm wearing their fibers or eating them at all times. So okay. Besides that, they're fine. But anyway, that's the storied history of the Shanahan family name, which my mum will like. And and an important, you know, yeah, my family's all journalists and stuff, and, you know, I love writing too as well. So I've been trying to write more under Shanahan. So if you see that, it's me trying to be less cool and just use my actual name and not some silly stage name.
Okay.
But it's good. It's good fun too, because the Mickey Finn's a great fly. And it's a great
name.
Exactly.
It's
it works name. That well.
So fly fishing, how did you get into it exactly? And I'm really curious about how you got into it professionally.
So getting into it in the first place, when we were growing up, we always fished down the coast mainly. So we'd go out and surf cast for, we call them salmon, but they're a giant herring, and brim, sea brim, which everyone will know and that sort of thing. But I didn't see someone fly fishing until we got our property up in the mountains and we started working on it up there. And we're right on a very famous fly fishing river here in Australia called the Murrumbidgee. And basically, one day we were driving along and I saw these guys fly fishing. I just thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And of course, I walked straight up to them with my spin rod, which I had at the time, with my little Selter or my little worm or whatever on it, and walked straight through a rising fish to come over and ask them how they were doing, you know. And they were actually quite nice, to be honest. They were like, oh, well, if you want to do it, then you should probably do this, this, and this. You know, little kid walks up to you and you'd be like, oh, well, you know, you can't blame a little kid. And I just got obsessed with it from when I was a kid. So I built myself a little fly rod and I'd run around without any great success all across the Murrumbidgee and the Snowies. And I did that all through school, you know, slowly kind of building myself up. I went to the library actually to get all the books because I'm of a vintage where we were just before YouTube and everything else. Plus, we didn't have good internet at my house and I didn't know how to do anything with computers in general. So I love books. And so I went to the library, got all of the fly fishing books, and the guy at the library gave them to me because no one at the school had rented a library book about fly fishing since the 70s.
Oh, wow.
And so he just said, take them home. And so I learned from three or four books, and a nice family friend taught me down how to cast one afternoon. And I just kind of tooled around. And, you know, Canberra, where I grew up, there's a lot of fly fishermen there. And there's a lot of, you bump into people, you pick stuff up. And I was kicking along. And as we'd finished the house, Mum and Dad would rent it out to family friends. And then Dad would just say, oh, well, Michael, we'll take you fishing or whatever. Or I'd be up there and someone else would come up there and I'd take him out. And at first it just started off as, you know, me running around madly being like, yeah, I've seen a fish here once. Come and give it a crack and, you know, helping out. And then about when I got my license, sort of 17, 18, I started getting a bit more serious about it. And then it was friends of friends and family friends and then people I didn't know. And then it got to the point where someone would be like, hey, do you want a case of beer? And to take me out fishing, be like, oh, yes, please. That's the best deal of all time. And I was just, you know, tooling around in my mum's old Toyota Camry, looking for spots to go fishing. But it started to just slowly evolve into more and more of a thing. And actually, one of my friends, Nick O'Leary, who I worked at a winery as well. So I do a winery season and then work at uni and then basically fish all in between and do a little bit of guiding here and there. He was really instrumental because he's a very good businessman. He said, right, you need to get a business number and you need to get this, you need to get insurance, you need to do that. I'm going to help you set it all up as your own little business. And so from when I was about 20, I had my own little fly fishing guiding business that I used to run out of the lodge. And then I got my first real big break when I was about just before I turned 21. I guided a fantastic guy, a very close friend of mine, Tom, who's from New York and then lives in Montana now. And so that's how I got over to Montana and met him and met his guide. And then it just all kind of kept snowballing and then ended up in Montana in our off season and then coming back to do our on season here and then working in the winery and teaching Phil by the wayside in the end. I just got too busy guiding basically. And it just kept building and building really nicely. Those guys in Montana, like my buddy Miles, taught me how to row a drift boat and everything else. And it was really cool working with my mate Justin and Joe and John and all the guys at Big Sky Anglers over there taught me up. And it was really cool to see how professional guide teams work and how outfitter systems work. So I got exposed to that very early on, which was radical. And those guys were really supportive. And they even brought out clients from Montana to come fish in the Snowies, which I thought was huge news. And, you know, you're going pretty hard when you want to impress them when guys coming out, you know. Not that I don't love all my Australian clients and you want to impress them too. And at that time, I was mainly all just, you know, wandering about and had a little four-wheel drive and we'd get about and do a lot of bank angling. But eventually, I wanted to start drift boating too. And this was about the time when I started working with Josh Hutchins. And so, because he used to run guided trips up to the Snowies too, because he had his own guiding business, Aussie Fly Fisher, and I had my little Mickey Finn's Incorporated vice president, junior vice president, standing before you.
What did you think when he was coming up here? Now that everyone's cool and friends and buddies, were you a little nervous that there was going to be competition?
I wasn't really nervous. I tried to rip on him a lot on the Yucumbean River. I tried, the first time I met him, I was making fun of him for fishing a Euro nymph rod because I was like, oh, nice rod, mate. I'll see you. Because he'd just written some story saying, you know, it was the greatest Yucumbean rod of all time. And I was like, this guy. And then I saw him and, you know, he's an awesome dude. But, you know, I was hurling abuse at him across the river in the nicest Australian way possible. You got to understand, if you like someone in Australia, you be mean to them, essentially.
Take the piss. Like, yeah, exactly. If you're nice to me, I'm wondering, if you are so polite,
exactly,
I just figure you're not comfortable with me and we probably aren't going to talk.
Yeah, which I feel is it's not an Australian trait. It's a very human trait. If you're not...
Very Canadian too, I'd say.
Yeah.
But no, I'd say it's pretty Aussie Canadian.
Yeah, a bit more laid back. I guess it could be misconstrued, I guess, in kind of the lower 48 as sometimes if you were like, hey, you know, you're bleep head, what's going on? Like, someone would be like, oh, exactly, what's wrong with that guy? Whereas here it's like, oh yeah, that's a nice dude, you know what I mean? So I definitely gave Josh a little bit of crap, but we barely ever saw each other. Because, I mean... So my season would be early season guiding on the hatch-driven stuff around the Murrumbidgee, and then I do 3 months of vintage at Nico's winery. And it was awesome too, because Nick was a mad keen, I mean, still is a mad keen fly fisherman, and go fishing all the time. And so I managed to time it where I do the early season and then vintage, which during the droughts and everything else, that was my least busy time of year anyway for guiding, so it worked out fantastically, and I got to learn how to make wine and drive a forklift and get in everyone's way, and everyone was very nice to me. And then by the time that finished, our big four lake runs start. And so then I get back out guiding and we get back into it and the season will kind of start again. And so I'd bump into Josh a little bit during those four runs. But we didn't have too much connection really in person, like maybe down the pub once or twice. And then he messaged me after I'd been guiding for a little while, and he just said, I think I was actually getting on a plane to go to Turangi, to go on a spay trip with my mates. And he sent me a message just asking if I wanted to call. I said, yeah, I definitely will, but give me 3 days. I'm going to the Tongariro and I'll be back and we'll have a chat.
New Zealand.
Yeah.
Sorry.
One of the big advantages of being in Australia, I mean, not for the last couple of years, but usually, is that if you've got 3 days off, you can just nip over to New Zealand and go for a fish. Like, it's pretty rad. And that was where I started my serious overseas fishing. As soon as I was 18, I saved up and I went straight to Turangi, and I've been there every year since, except the last two, obviously with COVID. And I'm very keen to get back and see all my mates, but especially Andrew Burden, the king of the mayor of Turangi. He'll he'll drink you under the table and spay further than anyone has ever seen. He's a weapon. But yeah, Josh basically said, you know, do you want to start doing some work together? And he had a couple of options, you know, and we sort of just went with, look, he'll take care of all the bookings, I'll come under the AFF brand, and then all I had to do was turn up and guide. So it was like, yeah, of course. And, you know, Josh at the time, he's Josh, he's got, you know, he's the world's greatest promoter of all time, and you meet him in person, and he's literally as huge as his promotional skills. So fantastic dude, and great mate and business partner, and we get along fantastically, and then we've just been kind of building it from there. So that would have been, I guess, 5 or so years ago, maybe 6, that we started working together. And since then, we've kind of transitioned from the high country, which is mainly walk wade days, over to the tail out side of the mountains, so the valley side of the mountains. And with what I'd learned in Montana from all the guys over there at Big Sky, we basically started building the drift boat business up, and that's been really fantastic. And now that we've kind of gone through a big season of drought and fires, and now everything's really wet again up the top, the high country is shaping up fantastic. I mean, the high country is always good for trout here. And we're kind of pushing back up into the mountains as well now. And I mean, how many guides have we got these days? 5 or 6. And I kick around and basically make sure everyone's got all the gear they need and make sure the clients all know where to go. And I go guiding every day and hang out with the boys in the evening and have a beer. And that's pretty much it at the moment. So
yeah,
it's all turned out reasonably well. You can sum it up pretty quickly. It hasn't been... I'm only 30. It's not exactly... exactly. So
I know you're so young.
Yeah.
Before we start diving into some more personal stuff, tell me about... Or can you describe the fishery to people and the landscape, and someone who can't envision what Australia trout fishing looks like, can you try to put a picture to it for them?
So international... Like, if I were to compare it internationally, you're looking kind of at if you were to go up into the foothills of the Rockies, or if you were to go up into the Catskills or something similar in that kind of US sort of thing, or like some of the Spanish streams and that sort of thing, where they're coming off quite dry plains and that, but they're high altitudes of cold water. We don't have crazy high altitude here. Like, you know, we're only at 200 meters above sea level. We're not high at all. It's because we've got a big tailwater here that the trout fishing is spectacular. And just at that mountain over there, you boost straight up to 1,000 meters. And then from there, you go up to 1,400 meters. And then from there, you go up to 1,600 meters. So we have consistent snowfalls up in these. They're not, we call them the snowy mountains. Compared to other mountains around the world, they're much more hills, big, big hills. And some of them are solid mountains, you know. No, actually, they're mountains. I won't draw them down that much.
I feel like they're mountains.
Yeah, they're beautiful mountains. I feel like they're mountains. They just don't do that thing that the Rockies do where they go straight up. So you kind of gradually climb up them. It gets colder and colder and colder. We get a really big snowfall. So our catchment, we've got a few different catchments up here, but they encompass an area bigger than Yosemite. So Kosciuszko National Park here, where we get all the snowfall, all the rainfall. It drains into kind of three or four major systems, and there's tons of creeks in between that. You've got high country fishing with three weights and little dry flies, and you can muck around in there. You've got big alpine lakes with big rivers running into them and some massive fish in those. We got a 6.5-pounder on the boat the other day. I had one of the lakes, and one of the boys got another 6-pounder yesterday. They're really on fire. I mean, I know this won't be relevant by the time it comes out, but get to Lake Hugemet, it's fantastic. And then you've got kind of spring creeks on the other side too, through very nutrient-rich valleys. And then you've got pine forests around here a lot too, because there's a big pine industry around here as well as everything else. But most of it is actually gum. So you could be walking through gum trees and have wallabies and kangaroos and echidnas and wombats and all the fun things, but you're in the snow. So it's a very surreal experience for a lot of people to be in the Australian bush, but you're walking along in 2 or 3 feet of snow in winter. And a lot of times our big, busy end of season, what you guys would call the forerun, I guess, for those big lake trout, they're big brownies, is a lot of that's in April, May. And in May, you can be up there in a blizzard. I mean, I've been up in January, which is our peak summer, and I've been stuck out in the Jujungle Wilderness in a 2-day blizzard, like just comes in out of nowhere. And
in January?
Yeah. You'll get them. We're high enough up where you can get that weather, and we're high enough up where it's crystal clear and cold, and the night times are just unbelievable. You got the Milky Way through the sky, Southern Cross. I mean, you know what it's like out here, and it's a massive wilderness area, and it's kind of my playground, so I'm quite excited.
I think it's highly, highly underrated.
Yeah.
And worldwide.
Yeah.
But in Australia as well.
Yeah, even me. I was just down talking. I'm calling them hills. They're the snowy mountains. They're real mountains.
I walk around just absolutely dumbfounded.
Yeah, fantastic.
You sent us to a little river yesterday, and I got the feeling like it was just a kind of a bonus river.
Yeah, that's just like a little fun one that's there.
And to me, I can't say the fish were world class because we didn't catch very many fish. I think we lost more fish than we brought in. But I would happily pay for a guide a day on that little stretch of river.
Yeah, and that's we've got tons of those little creeks and everything else. And then right here, two blocks from the house, which is the really beautiful thing about living here in Tumut on the Snowy Valley side of the mountains, is that we have the big tail out. So you've got the big tail water of the Tumut River, and that's got some absolute world-class fishing in it. So, I mean, you know, this season alone, I mean, you get really good numbers of fish. You can kind of have those really heavy nymphing days, so it can sustain that constant guiding pressure and just wreck pressure too as well. It's a big river by Australian standards, averages out about 2,000 or 3,000 megalitres a day, which, what's that in Cumex? I don't know, it's like a smaller, almost like the Gallatin River or something else like that, if you've ever fished across. I always compare everything to Montana because it's easy for me. The guys always make fun of me because they know I'm about to tell a long, boring story if they hear, well, in Montana, and then I continue to, but I do love Montana. But, it's a big quality tail section of a river, and it's just unbelievable. So drifting that, and during the summer, you get cicadas, you get hoppers, and it's big browns on the edges, or streamers too. And I just love it. Like, it's exactly what I've been looking for as far as like, yes, this is the place I will be. And I mean, you know, you've come around to my house this evening, which is awesome that we can, and you can literally sit out here on the deck and look out into the Tumut Valley towards Blowering Cliffs, and I can catch giant Murray cod in Blowering up the road too as well. But some of the biggest in Australia are in there too.
Now, for people listening, the Murray cod, and anyone who's listened to the show for a long time knows that I love Murray cod and that they're obviously native to Australia. Now, the trout are not. So what's the story there?
So the trout are not native to Australia. So what we have up in the Snowy Mountains is after World War II, they came in and built a big hydro scheme. Basically, because hydro is the future and everything else as it is, you know, as that happened a lot after World War II. And the hydro scheme at the time was the largest engineering project in the world. And it's a massive series of dams with connecting pipes so they can shift water around wherever they want. But what they created was a bunch of gigantic dams that hold a lot of fantastic trout. Now, trout had already been in there for a very long time. We've had trout, I believe, in the mainland for 150 odd years now.
Pretty sure 1864 was Tasmania, right?
Yeah, Tasmania, and then
so it wouldn't have been long after.
Yeah, I think it was like 10 years after or something for the mainland. And so our brown trout come from English chalk streams, the Tess, the Itch, and the Piddle, and one more, which is escaping me. Our rainbow trout come from New Zealand, and they came from Californian steelhead stock. So they were introduced well before all of the dams, and the river fishing up through there was fantastic up in the mainlands. Then they set up all these dams, and then it went insane because then you have these big dams. We've got a lot of crayfish here, a lot of midge, a lot of caddis, a lot of different things to start off different food chains. So we have heaps of water. And then you also end up with these tail out too as well. So you get these big tail waters like the Tumut, which are coming out of the bottom of dams. Now, of course, that's all reasonably artificial, and the trout thrive in it because it's the perfect temperature for them. But at the same time, they've really been working across the last 20 years to reintroduce native species into the best places for them. So, for instance, the Snowy Mountains isn't the best place for Murray cod because they weren't really up that high in the first place because it's quite cold. There would have been a lot of obstacles to migration and that sort of thing. But further down, when you start to get into this side, there are tons of streams like the Murrumbidgee down here, which is absolutely chockers with cod. And a lot of streams that might have been marginal, which would have been stocked with trout a few years ago, which they stopped stocking with trout, added some cod, and then the cod take care of themselves. So it's a really great bang for your buck when it comes to a fishery. And I personally, I love to mix fishery. It's my favorite. And you could come here, you know, fish for trout in the morning, have a snooze in the afternoon and go, you know, night fishing for cod with big poppers, and you can catch the largest freshwater species in Australia. So it's a real smorgasbord as far as species go. And it's not just Murray cod here too. We also have trout cod, and they're not a hybrid between a Murray cod and a trout. They're like the smallmouth bass of Murray cod. So a different species. They can interbreed a bit. But if they do, they're sterile. So you've got two distinct native species. I mean, three if you count Macquarie perch, they're endangered, but they're coming back too. So there's just a lot of really cool stuff happening on that native front. And we do a lot of native guiding too as well. And this season should be really good for it. Last couple of seasons with the fires were a bit tough. But now we've had all the water. The great thing about the natives is they're super resilient. They'll hang tough during fire seasons. And then when it's wet, they bulk up, they breed, they're good to go. So they're really great as far as the ecology goes, they're fantastic. And then as far as purely guiding goes, they're a great drought proof option that we're definitely looking forward to the future. But again, I love trout. I'm a trout guide who gets to go and hunt big predators, you know, in his free time and on some awesome guiding days, which I love. But the trout up here are self-sustaining, they're breeding, they do stock some fingerlings into the lakes, but they're mainly then get targeted by guys who are trolling and, you know, throwing lures or bait and that sort of thing. So it's good. It's a big recreational fishery. It's there for everyone. And we've got everything from, tiny streams to Lake Huachuca, which I think is 8 times the size of Sydney Harbour when it's full or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
I think. I always tell people that fact. I should probably check it.
We'll look it up. Oh. What about yesterday I found like a 3-inch long blue lobster claw. And Charles said that's a yabby.
So a yabby is one of the main big protein sources for our trout. It's actually one of the things that, like a lot of the Argentine trout, they eat a lot of those big crayfish. So we've got masses of these crayfish that we call yabbies. Okay. And then we also have a different species down here called the Murray cray, which is almost a freshwater lobster. It's huge when they get big, and they've got big white claws. They're delicious, highly endangered, highly protected, except for certain areas where you can gather them. But the Murray cod and the trout all eat those. And it actually means that, because, I mean, from time to time, like Eucumene at the moment has probably a million rainbows in it going through eating yabbies. And if you are going to take a little sustainable fish to eat a rainbow from one of the lakes, perfect. So, I mean, I live in the snowy, so I bonk a rainbow on the lake every now and again.
Yeah.
But we're all catch and release through the rivers and everything else. And I tend to put all the browns back too as well, because they're really self-sustaining and really interesting fish too as well. I love the rainbows too. I love big rainbows. They're my favorite. But I just love all fish. I just love them. They're so cool. They're just the best.
Why are big browns why are browns interesting, in your opinion?
Well, the browns here are very interesting. I've actually got to look into it a little more, but there's a book written called The Last Wild Trout. So our brown trout here, because they got taken over very early on, in before a lot of those English chalk streams. Now, those chalk streams have always been highly managed, highly everything else, but we got a lot of strains of them. They did very well down in Tassie and very well up in the mainland, and then since then they don't really reintroduce browns here. The browns need to take care of themselves. There's a couple of reasons these days. It's more, some of it's ecological in that they're very efficient predators and we've got a lot of frogs and everything else that are native, and so they don't like to put browns in places that they weren't. So it's hard to stop browns anywhere they're not already. And then also our hatcheries just don't run browns because they're a lot harder. And we don't have those kind of hatchery fish where it's, you know, you put and take hatchery sort of thing. They stock up fingerlings because a lot of our big lakes only have very small tributaries, which is good because it keeps us the numbers down, the size up. But then they chuck a bunch of fingerlings into some of those very large lakes, which just helps with the rec guys pretty much. And they also do really good genetics and everything else, so you're not getting the same sort of zombie fish coming back again and again or anything like that. But the browns, yeah, if you catch a brown up here, it's been here for 100 whatever years, and it comes from old English brown stock, and their genetics are actually super interesting. They've adapted really well to Australia, so they can actually take very warm water and a few other things, and they're just super pretty. I mean, they are
pretty.
Yeah, we do get a fair few cookie cutter rainbows. Like, you know, it's hard to tell one from the other a lot. But the browns, every one here is just completely different. You know, you can catch one that looks like a silver sea runner, and then the next one, big gnarly kind of caramel black spots, and then the next one's just fluoro orange, and it's their real kind of genetic diversity to them, which is very interesting, which I love to see. But
would they eat a big blue fly then? Because that blue yabby.
Oh, yeah.
Are they blue in the water?
Yeah, they're kind of blacky blue. I'm not so much about imitative colour options when it comes to flies. When I'm looking at flies, I'm always looking at trigger points instead. So I'm thinking, like, UV, for instance, on a tailwater is super important to me. I mean, especially for nymphing and that sort of thing, which is obviously where we're picking up a bulk of our fish with clients. But I'm always looking at sort of UV hotspots, and then if I'm looking at maybe a bigger streamer, I'm thinking profile, and I think more very much along, I'm of the Gallup school of, right, switch out from white to black to chartreuse to yellow than to olive and whatever, although usually you can just put on olive and roll with it, or white, just because I like to see them get eaten. But what the most excited thing I was to go up to Montana was to go into the slide in and meet Kelly and get some dungeons and then go and fish them, and I'm going in, I'm like, oh, hey guys, how's it going? Yep. Oh, hi Kelly. And you know, I'm sure it just gets this with every 21-year-old kid who decides to go to America. It's like, gotta go meet
total
Kelly.
Family,
yeah, yeah. Oh, dude, it's intense, man. And the guy's like, oh, Kelly will tie you up some bugs. I'm like, I'm not going to take Kelly Gallup's time to make him tie me dungeons. I'm going to ask politely for one or two and a photo. I've got this photo. I've got my Echo hat on and I'm shaking Kelly's hand and both of them out there, super excited. But I when it comes to those kind of color things, I'm more about switching through colors purely, and then sizes and that sort of thing. But I'm not much like, I don't own a single blue fly, and they are very blue in the water. But I think kind of when you're looking at it from a sort of perspective of profile and what throws the best shade and that sort of thing, blue is not the most important. Like, I probably go black before I go blue.
Yeah,
And even in my dries, and in my, like, I fish pink heaps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're hard-pressed to find pink anywhere on any of these rivers, but it slays, so in hotspots and that sort of thing. So,
what's your theory on fly color versus watercolor? Because that's a common question that I'm asked.
So I'm of two minds when it comes to watercolor specifically, and I've actually been thinking about this a lot recently because recently we've had a lot of water. And we've got the dam-controlled section of the river is always pretty clear. Like, I mean, it's either 8-foot visibility or 6-foot visibility, so it's pretty good. So, I mean, you can run pretty natural, although I tend to run, I'm not giving away any massive secrets here, everyone who knows, but I tend to run quite little bright hotspots of pink UV and that sort of thing, just to get the heat.
You've said hotspots. What do you mean by hotspots? Like a bead or a head?
It's usually, for me, it's usually a tail. Just a little bit of like glow yarn or whatever, or, you know, anything. I use a lot of this winging material that's really good UV, and I just use it for tails on these nymphs. Or you can have a hot bead, something like that. It's real, like, it's down and dirty. I'm going to get numbers of rainbows today for people. That's what it's about. It's like, right, I am going to run some jig nymphs and we are going to get some rainbows. And if I really want to slay, then I stick a Euro nymph rod out the back and then we just go through and vacuum clean the river. But I often don't feel that bad towards the fish that day to go and do that to them. But it's small profile, little, and it's tons of caddis in here too as well. So they're basically a little case caddis with a little bit of UV sticking out, and it's just, come and eat me now, please. And I don't really care what it is. If it's clear, bright day, I'm running a little bit of bright UV. Now, if it's a darker day, but we've got clear water, then I'll just run the exact same fly because I don't care. And it still absolutely cleans up.
Okay.
But if I'm looking at big browns on the edges of feeding a bit more meticulously on duns and stuff like that, then I turn the UV way back. Then I'm really on like just a plain pheasant tail or a shaving brush, something real drab, possum fur emerger, like drab day, and I'm hunting those big browns. You know, the rainbows down there, it doesn't matter. But when you get to dirty water, then there's definitely one or two ways you can go. You either just go dark. I was talking to Charles today about this, salmon and everything else. So, I mean, the traditional is you go dark and you get them, which I've done always in the past. And that really works well for nymphs and dead drifting stuff to get the profile, you know, because you want to absorb as much light as possible because they're hunting profiles in that water. But that being said, I'll throw a bright pink squirming worm and that'll get eaten. But that's also quite big, so it's probably just throwing a bit more profile. And I try not to go down those rabbit holes too much when I'm nymphing. But if it comes to streamers in dirty water, which I'm very serious about, I like fishing white because I can see it. Even though prudence says I should be fishing darker and deeper, I fish white and really shallow, and I've gotten some massive eats off some huge fish. And so I stick to that, or I cycle through into an olive, or I cycle through into a black until I get an eat or a follow or a grab. Because there's so many, if you try and come up with too many formulas, you're like, right, well, it's a dark day and dark water or light day, and you try and equal all that stuff out, you might miss something that happens to be happening on that day. You can't control the variables, but it's really easy to switch through options till something works. And if all else fails, just throw white because it's fun and you can see it, basically. Like, I mean, if I'm, like, when we were streamer fishing the other day, it's like, we're throwing white because we can see it. And I want to see.
It was way more fun.
Oh, man, I want to see a big brown crawl over it. Are we a higher chance on olive on that dull day with clear water? Yes, 100%. But yeah, they will still eat white, and it's sick because you see it from 40 kilometers away and you turn a brown trout into a barramundi. He comes and kills it.
I can't believe how aggressive they are.
They're nutters. Yeah. They're predators.
Coming up, Mickey and I get personal. Again, thank you to Great Fishing Adventures of Australia for making this episode possible. If you're planning a visit to Australia, I cannot emphasize enough that you must check out australia.com/fishing. When I followed my husband down here, I couldn't believe the opportunity I was witnessing. Huge fish, experienced guides, countless species. Australia is home to some of the most diverse quality fisheries on our planet. Great Fishing Adventures of Australia brings together some of Australia's best fishing operators to collectively raise the profile of Australia as a world-class fishing destination. Learn more by visiting australia.com/fishing.
This next bit is harder for me to transition into because I don't really know how to, because I don't feel like I don't know you that well, but
exactly.
I will say that I like interviewing people that I don't know quite as well. Let me explain. So Adrienne Comeau is my best friend, and she wanted to talk to me about something very personal. She suffers from serious depression.
Mm.
And we sat down to do a podcast, and it was so hard because I just know too much.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, as someone you love like that, you just don't want to overstep your boundaries.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm in the perfect situation right now in that I'm comfortable with you. And I mean, I'm in your home and we're friends and we fish together, but I don't know everything. In fact, I don't really know much about you. And I'm going to open this up and it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable.
No, that's, and to be honest, I mean, I think the best way to open it up is to explain that we recorded an entire podcast.
We did.
And I was having a pretty solid panic attack.
I didn't know you were having a panic attack. I thought you came across great.
The thing is, April, I'm very good at hiding it.
I know.
Yes, exactly. Which is one of the problems with anxiety and that sort of thing, which is... basically, yeah, what kind of gets to me a fair bit. So obviously massively different from Adrian's case in depression, you know, but I guess they're both different. I haven't started using words disease or anything yet because I don't really, because the other thing in my family, a lot of people have like hardcore diseases too. So they've got this stuff called Addison's disease and hyperparathyroidism, which is an autoimmune deficiency disorder. So they're quite sick. So I've got three brothers and sisters who are, you know, they're fine. They kick along. They're doing like, they're killing it. They just got to take their pills, otherwise they die. But it's, yeah, exactly. So in my family, we grew up and everyone was, if you were sick, you were sick. Like, it meant you had to go to the hospital because you were dying. That's it. So it's like, right, if you're a bit, you know, if you're a bit anxious, then, well, you're right. Like, just
get
to it.
Well, if you're anxious, man up, right?
Yeah, not even that. Like, my family's fantastic. My parents are very, like, that's the thing. I'm extremely, like, I'm the luckiest kid in the world, basically. I feel that my family's a testament to that, and everyone around me's a testament to that. But it's one of those things where if it's not, if you've got to prioritize stuff, and it can be tough when you have actual kids dying on you in hospital, and it's like, right. And even my family were very helpful and supportive and everything else, but then I was like, I gotta control this to make it easier for everyone else, which I think is probably a common mistake where people think that they have to basically take it upon themselves to shield their symptoms and their kind of problems from other people because they think asking for help is not so much a weakness. Like, I know it's not a weakness, but it's more, I don't want to burden other people with that thing. Or you feel you're going to push other people away with that. So if you keep it just level, and like, I used to always have these things we just called Mikey meltdowns about once a year when I'm just completely freak out and it's not very PC, but I used to call it spazzing out and just like disappear into the bush or whatever. And it'd be one of those things where I'd just come back and I'd be like, no, I'm fine now, it's all good, you know, and it'd be like, sweet, cool, we're done. But as I've been getting older, it's kind of like, and you're running your own business and you're doing this and you're doing that and you're, you know, trying to form proper adult relationships and do all kinds of things. It's like, whoa, man, this is very intense to deal with. And it got to the point probably last year or two was when it was getting really bad. But
what is anxiety? Because I have a few guy friends who have it, but I don't know what it is. And I find it interesting because I have found quite a few men that I know.
Yeah.
Do have some sort of, I don't want to say issues. I'm going to have to find,
I've got no idea. Quickly, like my terminology around all this stuff is terrible because I'm just like, oh yeah. Like I call my pills my crazy pills.
Right.
It's like, but for me, it's a good way to make fun of it. So I don't feel like it's weird. You know,
I think I bounce back because I don't know if they're suffering from depression or anxiety or if they've got some other, there's so many diagnoses.
Yeah, and I'm diagnosed with anxiety.
So
I don't have depression, so I can't, it's hard for me to distinguish the difference, but I would say...
Tell me what you have.
Difference, so with anxiety, you can be very high functioning and quite often, like, so for instance, like we recorded that whole podcast and you had no idea that, you know, I hadn't slept for the entire night and I was... could barely breathe leading up to it and the whole thing, but I can snap into it and I can play a role quite well when I have to, but I'm running at 8,000 miles a minute being like, right, don't say this, don't say that, don't say that, don't stuff up, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. It's a constant kind of Ferris wheel that slowly goes faster and faster and faster and faster and faster till it falls off the tracks.
And that's while you're speaking or after or both?
While I'm awake. So I used to like, and it's one of those ones where you're also, instead of just thinking about what you're doing, you find it very hard to focus on one thing or anything else like that. And I'd also say, I mean, all this mental health stuff, it kind of all, they all tie into each other and everything else. And it's very hard to diagnose any of these things. And it's incredibly personal for anyone who's going through it to figure out how they work with it and how they go through it. And I found that for me, pretty much, and just, you know, going through and looking at it as anxiety and looking at it as something to work on and beat, and then being like, right, I know when this is happening and now I know what to do because I've got coping mechanisms and everything else on top of that. But beforehand, and when it was really getting bad, it'd just get to the point where you'd be like, I'd feel maybe it's kind of, I guess, is it, and again, using depression as a point of difference is difficult because I don't really feel like I have depression. I'd get depressed about stuff, but I feel depression is like, you know, I listen to your excellent, you know, Adrian's fantastic thing where it's just, it's like, you know, a weight that just descends upon you. And you get that from time to time with anxiety, but you're just like, okay, just keep rolling. Like, you know, and if you need to, it's almost like you're trying to overwork everything and micromanage everything and keep this complex web together because you constantly feel like everyone's staring at you and everyone's judging every little thing you do. And that as soon as you stuff up, bang, that's done. That's done. That's done. You never, you know what I mean? So it's a weird, I'd almost just say it's like almost like a weird form of like hyper vanity kind of cross with a bunch of other things where instead of being, I guess vanity is the wrong word. What I mean is instead of being a reflective kind of thing or just thinking about, right, how can I improve myself? You're constantly thinking about others and how they see you and how you should be and everything else and tied in. I think, again, welcome to the surprise mental health podcast during the fishing podcast, but that's the thing. The reason everyone goes to fishing and that sort of thing, because the one time I'm not anxious is when I'm working so hard on getting a proper reach cast across that brown trout, I can't think about anything else. And it shuts everything else out. Then I catch it, and then I'm like, oh, man, what if someone saw me do a shit job from the road or whatever? Sorry for swearing. But anyway, it's one of those ones where I think the whole fishing, hunting, the whole outdoors thing ends up being a crutch in some ways. And it's good because it obviously lets people cope, but in a lot of ways it's also not good. Because it's fantastic once you've got everything sorted, because then you can even appreciate it even more. But using it as an escape mechanism, as a pure coping tool, I feel is dangerous. For like, I've started to realize, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about it, because I'm not a doctor or a lawyer, so I don't have client, you know, relation confidentiality, but it's like, I mean, but I see 150 different people a year. So, you know, but I do see it across the board, not just around clients, but, you know, within a broader fishing community, the whole thing. I think there's a lot of people out there using fishing as a coping tool and it turns up being a Band-Aid. Or even if they are using it as a like kind of open coping tool and be like, oh, this is what I do for my mental health and stuff like that. It's like, that's cool, man. But also go talk to your doctor.
Did you have anxiety as a kid?
Yeah, 100%. I had to get my appendix out and I couldn't, I'd get hand cramps. I'd start breathing so badly about, not just, you know, the appendix thing, but everything. I used to, every Sunday, shut down. I wouldn't be able, because I'd have to go to school on Monday. And so I'd freak out and I'd get these headaches and everything else. And at the time, it's just like, that kid's just tired. And probably I was. I've been skateboarding or fishing all day and probably not drinking any water. But at the same time, looking back at it now, it's like, yeah. And I was always like, people would be like, yeah, Mike's pretty anxious. And that's the thing. You're just really anxious. That's it. If you're anxious about something, that's probably, actually, this is probably the easiest way to describe it. If you're super anxious about something, like you've got a massive thing on tomorrow or whatever, that's that, but ordering a cup of coffee. Or one for me would be like just doing my client calls the day before and making sure everyone was on time and where they had to be. Or posting a letter. Like,
you mean interaction with people?
Not just with people, just anything. Like baseline anything.
So have to go do something.
Having to do something would come to this level of like where you then get, you're almost overdoing everything else and throwing your energy everywhere.
So you don't have to do that
one thing. So you don't have to do that one thing because it's so terrifying. Because going and getting a new tire is the most terrifying experience of your life, Michael. Like, no, it's fine. The tire guys are nice. They're not judging you. You know what I mean? It's one of those things. So
I've got so many questions. Hang on. So
go for it. Shoot.
So something like, okay, I can understand going and getting a tire or even having to get coffee because it's like you've got one sentence to say it right. Don't screw up. And then, yeah. Of course, you say something stupid. That I do that all the time.
Oh, no, but it's more like you're thinking about a joke and then you're like, but will this joke?
Oh, yeah, and then you like say the ending before the
final. Which is just normal. That's what everyone has.
But would you get anxiety then for something like going down to the garden to, you know, weed out your carrots?
No, that's different.
So it has to have people involved?
It has to, there's a couple of things to it. It can, you know, it's a blanket thing. It can be anything, right? But I tend to go and do the things that I shouldn't be doing, like mowing the lawns or weeding the garden or doing it when I know I've definitely got to pay my Telstra bill. And that's why I think that fishing ends up being one of those activities, because I would know that I'd have a list of jobs as long as my arm to do. But, and it's not like, I don't see myself as lazy really. Like although when I'm being super anxious, I do. I'm like, Mike, you're being lazy. You're not doing that. But I'll do a 15-hour day guiding and be like, yes, sweet. I don't have to do anything else. Like, you know what I mean? Like I'm using intense overwork to avoid other very simple work. And it's, not so much the people interactions or anything else. It can be sometimes, but oftentimes it's the, right, so if I post that letter, then that might lead to this, which might lead to this, which might lead to that, which might lead to that, which might lead to that. And you branch off into these mega trees of thought, which are just what disabling. Is? Yeah. And they're like, you just have so much going through and it's these infinite branches. And at some point you're just like, how do I shut this up? Oh, I'll just go, you know, go in a punching bag for a bit or mow the lawns or work on my motorcycle or go and cast my switch rod. And I know, and then it gets even worse because after that, when you stop,
horrible.
You're like, oh, now it's all compounded today. And that's where I think it's important for people to know who are using it as a coping mechanism, that as a coping mechanism, it's probably not the best. That as a mindfulness exercise, as anything else, once you've been a get properly diagnosed. It makes a huge difference. There's a ton of support out there. I was really worried about doing it because I really didn't want to go and talk to like a shrink sort of thing, like a psychologist or anyone else. Like ironically, now I'm talking to you about a podcast. And I don't want to be that guy who's like, oh, I've got, you know, this. So it's oh man, such a, please come and book my guided day. Like, you know, that's like the complete opposite. I'd like, if anything, I don't want to talk about it at all, but I feel that it's probably the smart thing to do.
Well, you're offering a very different perspective because I honestly thought that we were going to talk about how fly fishing was good for it as a cure. I never would have thought about it as it being such a scapegoat. And such an out that it actually makes the problem in your real life worse.
And it doesn't. And that's the thing. I think if you're the first step, and that's why, I mean, to be honest, my family and my wonderful girlfriend, everyone else, really awesome through all this. And to be honest, it's not much. Like, I'm pretty solid. Like, you know, I'm not dying. I'm currently fine. But it's one of those ones where Anne, my family, everyone else, they've eventually gone to the point where it's like, Mike, just go sort this out. And Anne particularly, like, she's fantastic. Like having a partner in all of that is off the charts. If you don't have a partner in that stuff, find someone else who can help you. Or if you're completely by yourself, give me a call. My number's public. Like if you're a fishing dude who has no one to talk to, I can talk, man. I will talk you under the table. And then the first thing is just go to a doctor. And that's the only step I had to do. I just went to one. He was the nicest guy ever. He was like, look, you can book a psychologist if you want, but realistically, COVID, everything else is going to take 3 months. And he was just really good to talk to, full stop. He was the nicest guy. And he still is. He's my GP. He's fantastic. But it's one of those ones where if you just do that, then it might be, sweet, just talking to someone helps. Or then going and talk to a psychologist helps for you or whatever, or a psychiatrist or whatever, and that sort of thing. And then you get coping mechanisms, and then you do that. Or, to be honest, and this was what I was really afraid of, is getting medicated.
Oh, I was going to say drugs. I know. Yeah.
That was one of the ones where it was like, you know, I was talking about those what-if trees before. I'm like, right, because I love being me. And you get those highs and you get the lows and everything else. And it's a pretty standard cliche. No one wants to lose the highs, but you want to ditch the lows. And it's like, well, how do you do that? Because it's just going to level me out like a zombie. And funnily enough, I couldn't get in to see a psychologist or anything else, and I didn't really want to because just talking to this guy was fantastic. He's a legend. And it got to the point where I was just like, And Anne was very supportive. She's like, look, why don't you try taking them? You have to take them for like a week or two, the ones I'm on or whatever. And feels bad, just stop. It'll be fine. I'm like, sweet. And we were going away, so I had to. And so I got the stuff. We went away for the first week. I was just like, oh, hey, what's going on? Like, I'd sort of not lobotomized, but just like
you're
weirdly level.
Hearing me? Okay.
No, but the thing was, I found out it wasn't because I'd been, I thought at first that it was because I couldn't, that I was just like feeling no emotion whatsoever, that I'd just been like leveled out. But then I realized I just didn't have the constant background radiation of intense mega, you know, when your speakers, like imagine it as speakers, you're trying to listen to a song, you can't really hear it, and your speakers are really crap. So you just keep turning them up, turning them up, turning them up. And all you've got is this intense white noise and the song there. You're like, yeah. Then imagine someone just cleaned up your speakers like that and it feels weird. And so you turn everything down and then you're like, wait a second, I can turn it back up again and the static's not there. Unless it's super intense and then it still comes back, but in a way that's manageable. And then I've got everything else. And then it's like, also I see it coming and I'm like, heads up, this one's going to be bad. And then we get through it and it's all good. So it's a weird, weird experience. And this is one of my major fears actually in doing all of this. I don't want to be, I don't even really care about the like typecast stuff. I don't want to be the mental health fly fishing guy because I'm a fly fishing guy. That's what I do. I don't do, like, I'm not a mental health guy or a professional or anything else. Like, when I say you can call me if you want, I'll be sweet. And then I'll just be like, call your GP, call your GP, call your GP. Those are the mental health specialists. Those are the guys who know what's going on. Like, you don't go to a baker or ask him to fix your diesel engine. Like, it's not, like, I'm a really proficient fly fishing guide, I like to think. Like, I like my job and, you know, and I like doing it with all my mates here and everything else. And I don't want to be that kind of like,
I won't label you the mental health.
Oh man, that's, it's like my number one. And it's not my number one fear because of the stigma. Like, I feel the mental health stigma is gradually fading and that sort of thing. And that's also one of my, like, I wanted to do that maybe just to help out a bit with some dudes who might be feeling, and I say dudes as well. When I say dudes, I mean men and women.
How do you, because while you're speaking right now, my brain is spinning wildly, right? Because I'm like, I'm trying to put everyone in these categories in my head. I'm like, okay, she's got depression. I'm a mega, you would never know, but I'm actually a crazy introvert. I just, a lot of those things that you're saying click with, resonate with me. I'm thinking about boyfriends and I'm like, okay, well, he may have had, he definitely had anxiety, but he was just a lazy
and
bum.
And it's a slippery slope because one of those things, so funny story, actually, we were watching, there's a TV show here in Australia called Love on the Spectrum, which is awesome. If you're Australian or if you can just get Australian SBS on demand, I think it's Australian Netflix or whatever. It's called Love on the Spectrum. It's awesome. And it's about various people with levels of autism and other disabilities and bits and bobs and that sort of thing. Just, it's like a dating show. And at first I was quite hesitant to watch it because I thought it would be kind of exploitive. I thought it was going to be like a bit voyeuristic and that sort of thing. But I watched it with Anne and it was just like the sweetest, best show ever. Because A, there was some total hilarious, like radical people on it. And B, it was just like, this is rad. This is cool. And then midway through we were watching it and they were talking a bit about autism and stuff like that. And Anne was just like, you know what? I'm not mad at you for not doing the kitchen anymore because I just realized you pretty much are autistic, like pretty much, like, you know, along those lines. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, you can't focus on more than one thing at once quite often. And you've got this and you do that. And you're like all the stuff they're talking about. I'm like, whatever, you know, bullshit. And anyway, she went to have a shower. And so I did a quick autism spectrum test and I didn't tell her the results because I wanted a level control. So I was like, here, babe, you do this. I found this, do this test. Let's see what you are. Anyway, it's a score out of 50. And again, this is a stupid online test. This is not a real thing, I think. I don't know. It probably, well, it's a real thing, but it's not definitive. Anyway, she got like 11 or something out of 50, which is like, she's like, yeah, most people are out here. It's just normal traits or whatever. I think I got like 28 or 30. And it was like, and it was like Asperger's syndrome. And now I don't have medically diagnosed Asperger's syndrome, nor do I think I really need to go down and get a thing for it because I think it was just a one-off little fun test thing. But I do have medically diagnosed anxiety, and I think it's a big difference to be like, oh yeah, this person has anxiety, or this person has ADHD, or this person has that. Like, They're medically diagnosed.
So many things, but they are all medically diagnosed.
They're medically diagnosed. And that's the key, is when you skip, and that's, again, this danger that I'm sort of harking back to, because, and it comes from me, a lot of times, I and it is more guys that on the boat, and they're opening up to me about stuff, which is awesome, and I never, of course, share any of those conversations. And again, I feel I take out a massive amount of people, so there's a reasonable level of anonymity. But it's one of those things where I'm like, dude, I'm not, like, I'll talk to anyone about anything on my boat any day of the week. That's your job. And it's also not just my job. I love my clients. Like, I've got the best clients in the world. I'm super lucky. I've one of the best fisheries in the world with all the best clients in the world. And then I get all my best clients from around the world and bring them here. So it's just fantastic. Like, Australians and all my American mates and everyone else, like, I mean, all people are fantastic, realistically. Sorry, I'll stop moving around on this chair.
Thank you.
But it's one of those ones where it's like, you can definitely go out, do that. But if you're doing that kind of stuff, it's probably best that you're not talking to your fly fishing guide about it. Go and talk to your doctor about it. If you talk to them, they are not going to push pills down your throat to start off with. My guy was like, first few months, he's like, no, let's just take a look, hang out. And that's most of their approach. Most of their approach is, let's fix this without medication. And then if we need it, let's try it. Oh my God, it works. Cool. You're sweet. And I think in the meantime, I've been using fly fishing as a crutch more than, it's not a repairing tool. Oh no, it is. Sorry. Let me rephrase that. It was a crutch for me at the time. Now it's a restorative tool because now I've got all my time down. Now I've got everything down. When I go fishing now, I can be wholly mindful of what I'm doing and I can use it entirely restoratively and everything else. And I can also be like midway through, like, I should probably call so-and-so today. Yep. Cool. Noted. Done. I'm going to do that. It's made me a better businessman. It's made me a better guide, you know, and I think a better boyfriend, I hope, and everything else in between. So that's the main thing. I say, go to your doctor first, get some that sorted, and then obviously go fishing still and definitely come out with us because, you know, we love guiding and, you know, we won't talk to you about mental health all day unless you want to, and then I totally will. But also that's, funnily enough, I've got to say the one caveat with all of this is I don't want to see this as conflated with what I do professionally. This is more, I'm just, as a fisherman, I see this is a lot, and as someone with anxiety who deals with it, and then I know other people have a lot of problems and everything else, don't push all your problems onto fishing. Sort your problems out, then go fishing. It's a million times better.
Look, it's the first time, and I will leave mental health off your title. So that we don't see you as the mental health episode.
Yeah.
And we'll finish up on fishing notes too, so that you don't, just because I can already tell you're going to sit back after this and you're going to think to yourself, what did I say? What did I say?
This one, not so much. Okay, the last one, 100%.
I want you to know that there are people out there who have exactly this, who maybe didn't even know that it was anxiety, or they've been too afraid to say it's anxiety, right? But this is great because this is the first time I've ever had that perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of that because I'm always the one who's like, go fishing to solve your problems. Go fishing to solve your problems.
Oh, and that's not a bad thing either because, to be honest,
that as a perspective.
And to be honest, if you don't have a mental illness, which you need to get checked out and need to sort out, if you're just tired and stressed,
go fishing.
Go fishing, 100%. But if it's starting to impact areas of your life where you are noticing it and then you're using fishing as an escape entirely, and then coming back to the reality feels awful again, probably time to go and sort that out. And it's pretty easy. It's like getting your oil changed. It's just a more expensive process.
Right. Okay.
Basically.
All right. Well, no, I really appreciate you sharing that. And it is definitely a perspective that I'm interested in hearing and I'm proud to share. So thank you very much.
Well, I thank you for putting up with me and also for, redoing this entire thing after I called you, I'm not going to lie, basically in tears. Big boys do cry. But it was one of those ones where I really, really felt that you do such a good job throughout all of your platforms at just helping people. And that's why I thought it might help people talking about that here. And if you want help with fishing, I'm probably way better at that, so please ask me more questions about that because, like, I couldn't even sort myself out. I needed my wonderful girlfriend and my wonderful family and everyone else to help. So no one exists in a bubble, and, you know, it's one of those things where just go grab someone and go have a chat and then go chat to your doctor. Those guys rule. That was the biggest thing for me.
Yeah, that's great to hear too. Because a lot, I think a lot of us think about doctors, and look, I love doctors too, but I always think to myself, oh, is he or she just trying to sell pills? Are they trying to make money off of so and so? So it's nice to hear that you've actually had a really good experience.
Exactly.
And recommend people do it.
Yeah.
You made your own raft.
I did. I knocked up a little, so it's basically like a ladder chassis frame. The raft we were on isn't my first raft. My first raft was the Ruby Slipper, named by John Heames, who he was the head guide at Trout Hunter back in the day. And then, so John Heames is like, you know, he's the king. Like him, Joe and Justin, they're my heroes, you know, and Kelly, of course. But Kelly's more like Streamer Jesus on the side, and the other three are like the Holy Trinity. I don't know. My family was super Catholic, so this is all going to come together. But it's one of those ones where John and all those guys, they're the ones, and my buddy Miles taught me how to row. They're the ones who are like, yeah, do it. Just go and do it. Especially Justin too as well. Justin's the nicest. He's just like, yeah, man, you're doing it. Get into it. Do it, man.
Nice
do it.
American accent.
Oh, I can do this all day. Don't worry. God. No, that one was ridiculous. But
how do you start? Someone who's listening right now who wants to do this, what do they do?
It was really hard to start off with because there's not much whitewater in Australia. And so I found a secondhand raft that had been used in New Zealand. I bought it, and then I just went on Google and just Googled how to build a raft frame. And it's like the first thing.
So when you say that you went to New Zealand, no, you
ordered
online.
One. Ordered one.
So you ordered the inflatable part, not the actual metal part.
The bladder. So I ordered the bladder. And then I just looked up how to build a raft.
And how much is that to order a bladder?
Oh, that first one was like, I'm not going to lie, it was pretty crap. It was like $2,000.
Okay, and it would be less expensive in North America, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's everything here.
So I run NRS boats here. So
okay, bladders.
And frames now too.
Oh, yeah.
So I've got three, well, we're kind of expanding out. So I've got three drift boats, so drift rafts. One with the frame that I built myself, where if you just Google how to build a raft frame, it's just a ladder chassis where you get aluminium. I built it in my back shed with a hacksaw and some little joinery pieces in about an hour, and it was fine.
An hour?
Yeah, it still is fine. It's like a big Meccano set. It's actually pretty easy.
Well, you just buy aluminum poles.
Yeah, and just grab a hacksaw.
Solder them together?
You can buy little joinery pieces for them.
Oh.
It's like a big Lego kit.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fun. And you can change it. So you can change it into two-man, or you can change it into single, or you can... It's just Allen keys, and then you can muck it all around.
Oh, no, a bird just hit the window, right?
No, that was Adelaide throwing a ball.
Oh. Yeah. I thought a cockatoo just hit the window, but it's actually my four-year-old. Okay.
But yeah, so you basically you just knock it all together, and then I went for it, and the Ruby Slipper was the first one, and it was small and really fun. And then I upgraded to the Blue Suede Shoe, which is the one you've been out on. And then yesterday, I believe, or the day before, we were out on the Gigi Hadid, which is, it's just a 14-foot NRS raft with full fishing frame package. Basically, every dollar I make just goes back into boats and various other equipment. So, and then I've also got a powerboat now too. So we can cover the lakes, we can drift, and our legs still work just great. So we can hike the high country and do everything too. But I love rowing. I'm actually really excited. I'm getting a little pack raft this week. And I've got my own a couple of grade threes, which are formed due to some, not floods, but usual clear water flows. Because you don't want to, if it's flooded, you forget it. But there's some really cool stuff I'm going to go and bash. And then eventually maybe get a big boat in there and have some more fun. Just build myself some Australian rapids and go for it. So, yeah.
When you fish in Montana, is it the same thing where you're trying to cast almost on the bank and then rip your fly back?
Yeah, if you're streamer fishing, yeah. Streamer fishing, you can fish them deep, you can drop them into holes, you can work them around, you just have fun with it when you're streamer fishing. But raft fishing in general, drifting in general, you're fishing ahead of the boat, up into the, like, say if you're throwing a hopper, you're throwing a streamer, you're pegging it at the bank, mending it, whatever, it's super easy and straightforward, and nymphing even easier. So I take out people, probably about 40% of the people I take out have never touched a fly rod before. And within the day, they're catching fish, having fun, learning to cast and nymphing away, and then chucking a dry on when we can and throwing streamers and doing whatever and just having fun, really. It's just a really fun way to live.
Five rapid questions.
Go.
And then I'm going to let us go eat your beautiful lasagna that you made.
Yeah, lasagna contadina.
Okay, here we go. Strip or swing?
Brown trout, strip. Yeah.
Why?
because I like to eat. I like them to come up and smash it, and I'm fishing off boats a lot, so I'm stripping it. Any other, like, you know, steelhead, sea run browns, salmon, swing all the way. I want to tug them. But brownies, man, just chuck it at the edge and strip.
Why on the Tongariro are you more likely to catch a rainbow trout than a brown trout on a swung fly?
Because there's about 8 billion rainbow trout. there are a lot of brownies in there. But it's just the time of year that you go. You can catch some awesome browns. The first trout I caught on the Tongariro was a brown on a woolly bugger swung when I was 18.
They will take a swung.
100%. Yeah. Okay. I mean, but talk to anyone else about the Tongariro, because I've been going there, 10 years, and I'm a complete doofus and I've got no idea what's going on. Talk to Andrew Burton about the Tongariro. Okay. He's fun. He's cool.
But the same thing in this river, same answer here in the Snowies?
No, yeah. In fact, you're probably more likely to get a brown in here because they're a bit more predatory in here. And it depends what fly. You know, if you're swinging a nymph, you're going to get a rainbow. If you're swinging a... Like Morsi got his best brown on the swing down here. Got a 5.5 pounder. Landed in the water, bang, on. It was awesome.
Are the fish biting better when the water is rising or dropping?
Rising, I would generally say. Yeah.
Really?
Here. Again, this is tailwaters. Even up in the high country, you get a bit of rising water coming up here. They love it. Depends. Can't if it rises so much that it floods out, then it's not as good. Dropping, you're probably dropping and warming up. You're probably getting better hatches. I mean, it's a really, for up here, there's so much different stuff that sometimes rising, sometimes dropping. On a tailwater, generally rising a little bit's good. But dropping's still pretty good. Probably the rising bite is better for browns and the dropping bite's better for rainbows here.
Okay.
If that helps.
Yep. What's the biggest difference in trout behavior that you notice when the water gets murky?
They slide right up into anything. Anything. As soon as it gets high, you've got to be... Don't wade. Fish that far from the edge. Like a bee stick, as we say here, from the edge is where you want to be. Because they're in that. And they'll find anything. Pull trout out of chocolate milk and 6 inches from the edge, an inch from the edge. That's where they're at. And yeah, definitely fish those edges because that's where the food is. The nymphs move out, get flooded in, those little back eddies form, all the worms get chucked in there, get dirty and get on the edge. That's what I do.
Kate, last rapid fire. What would you like to see Australians bring to this country that you really enjoyed in America?
Fly shops with kegs in them. That would be cool. One of my favorite things about being here in Tumut is the American outfitter style and a fly shop as a hub. And it's real. We're really lucky we've got one here. Like Chris and Gemma do a fantastic job down at Tom's. Like I can get off the river, get what I need and just hang out with my mates and see everyone. If they relax the liquor laws a bit and we could put half a drift boat in, like there are some... I just love going to fly shops in the States. It's just, you could just go there and just go to fly shops. It's like when you go to Italy, you go to every single church and museum. When you go to Montana, you just go to every single fly shop and they're all different and fantastic. And I just loved working in Big Sky Angles over there. It was heaps of fun. And we'd just all hang out and just a beautiful shop on the corner. So in West Yellowstone, there was right at the corner of the T Junction. You see all the tourists go past and you'd be up until 10 o'clock at night, just pumping tunes and guys be coming in, getting everything for the next day. And then you wouldn't sleep. You'd go swing to Madison at Mice at night and then go to a party and then go back to work or then go row and do whatever. Like, yeah, just the fly shop culture there, the fly fishing culture there is on point. I love it, especially from Montana. I've done a little bit of fly fishing around other parts of the States, but that Montana fly fishing culture based around those outfitters. And I really love it. I love the other thing everyone over there could bring, which again, this is probably adding the last one to your rapid fire, is the sense of, like, I was in a town there with 6 fly shops and you see all the other guides at the bars, everyone buying each other beers, having chats, everything else. Like, there's not that level of territorialism that you tend to find in Australia because we haven't got as much fresh water. So I think guys get a bit cagey about it. But I think, to be honest, man, if everyone was just happy, go lucky and hanging out and probably has something to do with the fact that they have kegs in fly shops, that would be sick. I'd be all over that.
The world would be a better place.
Exactly.
Well, I will wrap it up. Thank you very much for doing this in person.
Dude, thanks for having me and thanks for, everything. You're the best.
Likewise.
Keep doing what you're doing. Let's do it. I got lasagna ready to roll.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Tune in next week when I sit down with Marina Gibson.
Through the Blackwater bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinner's crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
You're listening to the Waypoint Podcast Network, brought to you in part by HuntStand, the number one hunting and land management app.